is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is finally Thursday.
It's Juneteenth.
Juneteenth. It's the 17th then?
19th.
See, same thing. I was going to mess up the date. But it's Juneteenth.
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 Yeah.
Okay. Give a narrative. I want to see how good you are. I mean, I understand, but you give a narrative.
That I've been to church once and you feel like you're just testing me. Hey, okay.
Go ahead, go ahead.
So Juneteenth is American Emancipation Day for the African Americans. Of course, the way we are, everybody was freed once African Americans were freed. That's when slavery ended.
C plus.
Isn't that when slavery ended?
Not technically.
I mean, we know that it didn't technically end at all because here we are. We also know that people were sharecropping all the way up into the like some people didn't even know up until the 70s.
Entirely different narrative.
Okay.
So you know there's the Emancipation Proclamation in the United States with Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Right? Where they freed all of the southern slaves.
Yeah.
Not the northern slaves. Apparently some on the outskirts weren't, it was allowed to have slavery.
In north.
And then
which is
after,
ironic.
Yeah. Then after the revolution, most people thought they were free, but Texas had slavery. This man I were, but you all. Texas had slavery. And Juneteenth is when Texas, in particular, last state, say, man, yeah, enough of this. We ain't have no more slavery. And in fact, Juneteenth was celebrated only in Texas for a while, and then it permeated throughout the whole United States when Biden said, hey, man, this is what it is.
So sort of kind of...
Yes, that's my guest, by the way. I was going to surprise people, but he has knowledge in history. Let me introduce him properly.
You can get a grade, too.
You got to give me a grade. That's Dr. Ian Strawn, who's our guest for today. We're talking about what he's doing for the next couple of months and a big project that is happening for the University of the Bahamas that he's going to give us some detail about. But we're going to exactly talk about him for a brief moment. But we already start with Juneteenth, so we got to get a narrative for that. Officially, go ahead.
So now, all I was going to say was that the best way for Bahamians to think about it is it's America's version of Fox Hill Day.
I'm going to explain that.
Because right. Fox Hill Day is a week late. Right?
So it happened because news didn't carry as it ought to have.
You know, right? I can challenge that. Me and Fox Hill said that never happened to us. You're trying to write us a script on us. Fox Hill Day is a church celebration, but it's the narrative about getting the news late is good too. I'm not saying that we should shed that,
okay.
But just that dying reason why we have Fox Day, okay. Fox Hill Day. But I embrace that story because it's a good story for tourists, and it's a good story, feel good story. But Fox Hill Day was a church, for church thing.
Okay.
But I love
was
that.
It a Christian church or African church thing?
All our Christianity in the Bahamas is African based. Even the Catholicism.
I mean, all Christianity is African-based.
That's even a whole different narrative, but I like that too.
Yeah.
I like that. But without further ado.
Right, so yeah, it was, well, okay.
Go ahead.
So, that was all I was going to say. It was about news not getting to them.
And I love it.
Two years later, and as you know, post George Floyd, these gestures, this was one of those gestures.
I love gestures.
That was made, yeah.
You like gestures?
Sometimes.
Okay, good.
Sometimes.
We have Dr. Ian Strawn. There's a number of people who got excited that he's coming in studio. I'm excited coming in studio. I say, Aaron, stay back. Aaron say, I want to interview myself. No, Aaron, this is my guest. You work on your own guests, right? Because I want to talk to with Ian Strawn about what he's doing recently. He's been quiet. I know he's the lead or head of University North in Grand Bahama. You know, they're doing some transition there. But I want to know like what is on his writing block because he's doing some, like one or two big projects. I was whispering and say, okay, I can't wait till that come out. And I said, let me invite him on to explain all of that.
Okay.
And then we go into further our story.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here with both of you. So basically, where am I? I'm on the very, very last moments of my role as vice president of UB North. I'm actually taking a sabbatical So my term has ended, and an acting vice president has been appointed for UB North. That's Denise Barnes. And so I'm on sabbatical as of July 1, taking an extended vacation right now. And I am busy, yeah. I'm working on a number of projects, artistic projects. One has been going on for, I guess, about 2 years. I did a play a while ago called Honorable Member, and it was a political satire. And the idea came to turn that play into a TV series. And so basically for the last year or two, I've been working with a bunch of actors and some partners of mine, Dion Johnson, who's the lead actor, Dawn Sargent, who's the cinematographer, and Aaron McKinney, who helps me with the, is the production manager. And so we've been producing this show, and hopefully we'll have the show on air by the end of the year. So very excited about that. It is about our politics. It's about the 10 rules of politics, actually. It's a sort of mostly a comedy. People would probably remember Gippy's Kingdom. This is something slightly different in terms of its style, but it's really been fun working on it, and I think people will really enjoy it. And it's hopefully right in time for the season we're going into. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's that. And then, you know, I would have released my novel last year, Blind Days. And
how's it sailed? Remind us what the novel's about. I had some people from Crooked Island reach out to me recently and asked if that the Moss mentioned in your book is from Crooked Island. I said, no.
You didn't tell them no.
I said, no, that's Exuma. But no, you can write the story. You can tell me.
Oh.
But I could have guessed it. They wanted to purchase some of your books to keep in their museum in Crooked Island.
Yeah, and so you, I and can you discourage them.
No, sorry.
See, so why you do that to me?
I can inbox them back and say, yes, it's those Crooked Island Mosses.
It is. Right, so Henry, well, the Mosses actually were, James Moss was the largest slaveholder in our country. At the time of his death, a lot of his slaves were sold. He actually had more slaves than Lord Roll at one point. So that name would have been more common in the Bahamas than Roll. But in any event, one of his descendants, a nephew, Henry Moss, had a plantation in Crooked Island, and that plantation is the subject or the location of the novel that I've written about Kate.
So that's completely wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like just around Langell Point. Mm-hmm. And it's a story that actually became famous because of the cruelty that they subjected her to, but more importantly, because it went to court. They were actually tried for how they treated her. So I wrote a novel wanting to really try to give us what slavery might have been like, and use a lot of the historical records that I had access to, like the minutes of the trial and letters from the governor and letters from the Mosses themselves when they were in jail, letters from the colonial secretary to try to piece together an image of really a heroic woman, a heroic young woman, Kate, who resisted her master and mistress. And so that novel, Blind Days, is on sale. And now I'm actually also working on a stage version of the novel. Oh, so nice. That's what I've been working on, trying to create a different type of experience from the same material in an hour and a half or 2 hours and be immersed in this particular piece of drama. Now, quite to my surprise, Kate was recently named a national hero. And next week, I think they're going to unveil a plaque at the archives honoring her. I've been asked to read, so I'll be happy to do that as well. So,
nice.
Yeah, so definitely I am a descendant of the Mosses.
You look like them. I mean, the Mosses or the Moss slaves?
The Moss slaves.
Okay. I see you trying to get... You see that, right? You see what I did just now?
Yeah, yeah. That's very important.
He's trying to clean those white people's legacy. No, I wasn't.
But you're right. I am a descendant of... And they carry that name, right? So my family is from True Blue, Crooked Island. And then I have Hannah's on the other side. Mm-hmm. So, Crooked Island and Auckland's are where I'm... At least one half of my family tree comes from.
and this is my benefit now, and forgive me for asking this. Is there any Moss family tree, or are there different sections of mosses?
Well, they gotta be, right? Okay. I mean, and then to, you know, there are mosses in other parts of the country, right?
Yes. Exuma Moss. Like, yeah. That's why I thought the story was based on.
Yeah, yeah. So, I only know up to my great grandfather. I haven't gone further. I probably should try to go quickly. Mm. You don't have much time.
Yeah.
So that's been, I mean, I'm really very, very happy that I was able to finish that project. It took a long time, but I really enjoyed it. And so I'm hoping that we can have conversations about our history, about slavery, that people could be comfortable talking about it.
And you mentioned comfortable. Is it such a thing as being too black and scary?
Yes.
To talk about it?
When I say, is there such a thing? For some people, right? For some people, they can get very uncomfortable, black or not black, with certain types of discourse, right? Certain types of conversations, and even certain attitudes and postures. Just think about in my own lifetime, the attitudes toward Rastafarians, for instance. When I was 11 or 10, Bob Marley came in and gave a concert, International Year of the Child, it was. That's actually on YouTube, you can listen to the concert.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that helped spur the spread of Rastafarianism in this country. Then there was a lot of discomfort with what is essentially an Afrocentric way of living, right? So, but definitely I think in our society, our tourist economy, and our country, there is a certain reluctance to truly discuss the legacy of slavery. Because we're afraid, it seems, of how people will feel, white people will feel, mm-hmm. but also how black people will feel if they have to carry that consciousness around with them every day, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a fear of knowledge.
Right, and I think... not wanting to have to acknowledge these, like, how many struggles do I need, right? Like, I'm already struggling as a black person contemporarily. Now you want me to hold the struggles of the past at the same time.
But the struggles of the present are the result of the struggles of the past, are they not?
It's a part of it that we also don't want to acknowledge maybe ways that we feel we are complicit? Because... back then, because it would then cause us to have to acknowledge the ways in which we are complicit now in other people's oppression.
Absolutely. So I went to a conference recently, Caribbean Studies Association conference. The focus was on reparations. I presented a paper, which I'll also present hopefully at the conference, which we'll talk about in a bit. And it was really about, okay, so we're looking for European nations to pay reparations to us, the black world that suffered, right? The diaspora that suffered mm-hmm. because of slavery, transatlantic slavery. I think there's reason to be skeptical that will ever happen, right?
Oh, yeah.
But outside of that, my presentation, my question really is, you have Caribbean nations that have black governments. Have we, as sovereign nations, done everything that is in our own power to restore or to repair the past of slavery, right? And I believe the answer is resoundingly no. And so it seems to me that we ought to begin with what we have control over. I'm not saying we shouldn't make a case for justice and for reparations for payment. Many people may not recall, but when slavery was abolished, the owners of slaves receive compensation, financial compensation for the loss of their property.
And we, the descendants of slaves, participated in the repayment of the bonds taken out, right? So the bonds taken out to pay those slave owners to compensate them for the loss of their capital, that bond was not repaid until 2015. So those of us and our ancestors that lived in colonial systems and paid taxes and sent tax back to the queen, to the crown, we were paying back the bond that was taken out to compensate the people who lost our parents and our ancestors as capital.
So again, the question for me is, well, what is it that we as a nation that was born out of first, well, you know, the genocide of Native peoples, but then also the Holocaust of our own extraction, violent and traumatic extraction from Africa, and then exploitation as free labor here in these islands for hundreds of years. What, not to mention the lasting effects, what can we do that we have control over that says we recognize the dehumanizing things that were done to us and our ancestors, and we will do everything in our power to restore or make right. Mm-hmm. And to me, that has all sorts of implications. It has implications for how we look at property, how we look at work. It has implications for how we look at our topography, our landscape. It has implications for how we teach mm-hmm. In our schools, what we teach. It has implications for what news we cover every day, right? So when I sit down and watch the evening news, I get a snippet of basically American news. But I don't know if people follow where I'm going with this, but yeah. We are a part of a black world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We ought to be, right? So just thinking, trying to think in 360 degrees about what that would mean if we were serious about restoration. And the first and simple one I will give you as the example is, well, what would it mean? Okay, you look for the West or the developed North to pay you for what has been done. But you have access to hundreds of thousands of acres of land that belongs to the people, right? What are you doing to restore?
Deliberately.
Rather than, and let's acknowledge that what happened in 1838, which is the end of apprenticeship, was we started on a journey where we were several laps behind the white minority, mm-hmm. right? So that's a gap that still remains. Some blacks have become part of the oligarchy, right? Mm-hmm. But again, if we are a commonwealth, we should have wealth in common, right? So what are we doing as a society? What have we done since 67 to actually level the playing field? Right, mm-hmm. so which we ought to see as imperative given the history of the country.
And I think like,
right. So and the last thing I'll say, and then I'm mm-hmm. welcome. If you think about, just think about it as like the state of Israel, which is of course mm-hmm. very controversial right now because of the genocide that they are committing and so on. But one of the things that the Jews have said coming out of their Holocaust is never again. Mm-hmm. Right. What if black people in the Caribbean said never again? What if we insisted on remembering in every way what slavery did to our religion, to our language, to our dress, to our minds, to our sense of beauty, to our sense of our own ethical or moral virtue, to our knowledge of our past, to work, to our notion of work and property, because we were property, right? So you'd think then that a country that's conscious of those things would be intentional about how it looks at economy, how it looks at investment, how it looks at development, how it looks at culture, how it looks at education, in terms of trying to create free people. So you want justice from the North, but you don't practice justice. You don't practice equality. You don't. You see what I'm saying? You don't practice freedom. So that's just... Yeah.
The example I wanted to use was Free the Puff, the incident that arose from C.R. Walker, right? That if we were serious about our demand for reparation, right, then we would recognize that the from consternation to outright bigotry that we hold in our hearts about locks and Africans wearing natural hair, we would do the work and realize that is something rooted in us from our colonial experience, our experience of enslavement, that it wasn't until the 40s and 50s that the last Caribbean country repealed the law that you could shoot a dreadlocks person on site and the family have no recourse. You could kill them on site, no problem, the law permits it. Then we understand that that's why, fast forward 100, 150 years, We still beating children for wearing their hair naturally. We still telling black people that, no, you got to figure out how you're going to afford to change your hair to fit this European aesthetic, when very easily a country like the Bahamas, as opposed to the U.S., right? A country like the Bahamas, we could put that in legislation right now. Young men and women are allowed to go to school with their natural hair. We just require that it be clean or it be wrapped, right? Or whatever, but we have... We're sitting here demanding reparations, some of us, without acknowledging how we are reinforcing those same systems here and to our benefit in some way.
With that, let's talk about the future of our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I want to understand what is this Future of Democracy conference, the history of it, how did it come about, is there a need for it? And then we start talking about the details of it in general. But go ahead. What's the Future of Democracy conference?
Yeah, so the origin of it, well, this is about the fourth one, so it's been happening. I took quite a break because I decided to become a university executive. But the notion is that citizens, activists, scholars, just concerned citizens, should be able to convene and talk and reflect about the type of country they want to live in. How they want to be governed, what are the best mechanisms or models by which we should be governed. A university is a place where ideas are supposed to contend, where you're supposed to explore and pursue the truth. I wanted to create a space where citizens, not politicians, not elected officials, not people looking for to hold office, but people who were not political combatants or competitors, could speak on a nonpartisan way about governance, about democratization, about transparency, about accountability, about I guess you could say inclusion, about rights. And that was a conversation that I didn't see happening. I mean, obviously, you have the journalistic space, you have media, thank goodness for it. It plays a very important part in democracy. You have now social media, which allows people some platforms where they can speak. But I wanted to create a space where we could, in a civil, dispassionate way, look at the phenomena of politics, right? The way we govern, and imagine how it could be made better. The presumption is that, for instance, your constitution, though it's the prevailing law, is not necessarily perfect. Your laws are not necessarily perfect, and certainly in practice, what we have is not perfect. So, for instance, today in the Bahamas, there is no transparency on a number of levels, like campaign finance reform. We don't know. We have speculation, is word on the street. Well, who funded political parties in this country in the last election? Who will fund them this time? Who are the stalwart counselors? Who are the people, the real people, who decide who will become prime minister? We don't really decide that. I could argue that that's really decided by the delegates of the Free National Movement and the Progressive Liberal Party. So whoever they choose has a 50% chance of becoming prime minister. You vote for a member of parliament, right? So is that the best system for us? Because I think we have a right to question whether first past the post is best, whether senators should be appointed or whether they should be elected. We always talk about whether you should have local government in New Providence, but we never do it. The Freedom of Information Act has been passed on like a baton and a relay now for about four administrations, Ingram to Christie, Christie to Minnis to Davis, and it still hasn't been implemented. That's 20 years. So the fundamental notion is to believe that a key part of better governance, or a better Bahamas, a more prosperous Bahamas, would be citizens being more engaged, citizens being more informed, citizens being more active, and maybe even more focused and concentrated in how they address national national development, national cultural, national national governance issues.
I want you to continue on that wicket, right? But I have a question from the texter.
Yes.
So I'm going back, and then I want you to go back forward.
Sure. Sure.
The question is Kate, poor black Kate,
mm-hmm.
Is Kate even real, a real person? Why is she being made a national hero? Uh-huh. This is truly a mediocre society. And Ian is one who is afraid to discuss slavery in depth.
Before you answer, Mr. Strawn, let me say this. Poor black Kate Moss is as real as our cousin Muffin, who I ain't gonna never forget, right? She is as real as our cousin Muffin that we saw with our own eyes what she was going through. I mean, that's not even up for debate whether Kate Moss was real or not.
Well, again, the archives is a wonderful place. And there was something done during slavery in the latter part of it called slave registries.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of census where they recorded everybody who lived on a plantation, mm-hmm. Whether they were male or female, their name, whether they were African birth or whether they were what they call Creole, in other words, born in the Americas,
mm-hmm.
and which island, obviously, they were on, right? Sorry. And Kate's real. Kate's a real person. She existed. She was killed. And there was a trial. And there are actual minutes of that trial. And there was a ruling. And there was a conviction. And then there were ripple effect consequences of it. And then there were letters from the governor. And then there were letters from the colonial secretary. And then it was discussed in the British Parliament. What happened to this black girl?
Mm-hmm.
That is factual, right? So that's one of my admirers.
That's important to me because in 300 years, they're going to say, what you mean Aaron Green was real? They're going to say, you can't tell me that a sissy woman with black woman with locks was on the radio talking to people every day like she was people. You're gonna erase me from the history books just like that, caller? Let me text her.
That girl back to you.
Progress.
Future of democracy.
Yeah.
Progress.
This is the fourth one.
Yes.
When is the date proposed for it?
Well,
who is gonna be presenting? Who should attend? Stuff like that.
Right. So the reason why I wanted to get an opportunity to talk about it is because there's a deadline coming up for it, which is at the end of this month. We're inviting people who want to be a part of it, the conversation, who want to maybe make a presentation, talk about some particular element, some particular aspect.
Give an example, because I don't understand exactly what you mean, participate.
Right.
How can I participate? How can Erin participate?
All right. So, I mean, Erin has participated in the past, and she's going to... doing again, she's been promising me that she will, and I'm holding her to it. Essentially, all you have to do is send me an email with your proposed subject.
Yeah.
And, excuse me.
A 250-word abstract.
Which is just a summary of what it is you want to talk about. And you send it to my email at ian.strawn@ub.edu.bs. And the committee will strike a committee. We'll look at all the submissions we get, all the suggestions we get, and we will respond and say, we'd love to have you. Here's when you will present. And give you some examples. There's a flyer on Facebook that's been disseminating. Some of the things that you might want to consider talking about: electoral reform, procurement, the role of the Privy Council, local versus national government, land reform, transparency and accountability, governance in Grand Bahama, youth and politics, journalism in the Bahamas, identity politics.
Consumer rights, government and big business, third parties of the future, the poison of patronage, disobedience.
You said third parties.
Change.
Yeah. So that's like COI that could come and give a lecture?
No. What I want is people to think about and speak about the roles that third parties could play.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily meant to be a platform for political aspirants, like I said before. So we're not going to have the chairman of the PLP or the FNM or the mm-hmm. president of or the head of COI come and make a case. This is not about campaigning. This is about citizens who are not declared agents or workers or representatives mm-hmm. to talk about the type of country, the type of political parties, mm-hmm. the type of elections, the type of governance they want.
What about Rastafarianism? Can they come?
They're not trying to get. They definitely ain't getting no votes. They ain't asking for no votes, right?
So, but they can come.
They can come.
Social media and the political landscape.
So people from social media.
No, so you could submit an abstract. You should submit an abstract about the public intellectual and social media.
Okay.
Right?
And people might see you as a nuisance, and so you might wish to explain to people the actual very good work that you do.
I like being a
by nuisance
as a provocateur, right?
Right, as value.
Yes.
Listen. Governance, this is suggested area. Governance under Ingram, Christie, Davis, and Co.
Oh, so that could be a lecture? What that'll be about?
No, it depends on how you want to frame it.
So again, in the past, we've had scholars, right? We've had, but we've also had activists. Every time we have this conference, we try to bring in an expert from the region we've tried. We had scholar Obika Gray, who's a Jamaican political scientist. We've had the head of the Trinidad Integrity Commission. This time we're going to have a professor who focuses on what's called clientelism, which is a fancy technical term for what we usually call patronage. In other words, you know, hooking people up, basically. So the culture of that in our society. And again, the focus is the future of democracy. In other words, where do we want to go? Okay. What can it be? What can it be? And how do we get there? Now we have had people who used to be in the political arena, but have stepped away. So, for instance, we had Loretta Butler Turner present once. We had Shivago Lang present.
And then we had somebody who said they was never going to join the political arena, and then they dove right in.
We did. We had Adrian Gibson, who was at the time a columnist, and would eventually offer himself.
And let me just make the point, though. After declaring emphatically that he would never enter politics, I ain't gonna tell the people why, Adrian. I mean, it's on record. You said it. But why you wouldn't enter politics? I'm just saying.
So one good thing is that we videotaped a lot of these. And so in the run-up, the event is actually in October. We're gonna post all the videos that we have, including Mr. Gibson's presentation.
So, Nuri, when we mentioned governance under Ingram, Christie, Davis, and Co., the framing of a conversation I thought about was the question of whether only lawyers could be good prime ministers, or whether lawyers have created a system where only lawyers can lead effectively.
We have a telephone call here. Let me have this person engage Dr. Ian Strawn regarding this conversation. And I want you to give out your email address so people can contact you who wants to participate in it. Mm-hmm. Yes, and more information about the conference in general.
Yeah.
And what do you mean by conference for the person who's never attended it before again? Go ahead, caller, Guardian Radio AM.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Neary. Good morning, Ms. Green. And good morning, Dr. Strawn.
Good morning.
Yes, I hear Dr. Strong was talking about the slavery and discuss slavery and the different things, that how we would probably look at things differently, some of the things we would look at differently. And I feel like one of the greatest things that we would look at differently is immigration. You know what I mean? I think if we were taught to look at slavery from an African perspective, that we wouldn't have this big issue that we have with immigration on here, because immigration is the one issue that Bahamians draw political differences for, and they unite passionately. And there's no other issue that they do that for than immigration. So we would solve that problem by seeing our African brothers as ourselves. Then maybe we could talk about real issues and things that really change our society. Because, you know, Ms. Green was talking about the public intellectuals and stuff like that, right? And intellectual people. And and when it comes to slavery, I wonder why there's not a deeper conversation as it relates to religion. You know what I mean? I mean, especially how if you are an intellectual, a person who believes in the Bible or whatever, you know the story about the Bible. You see in the Bible it talks about oppression and false God and for all these different things, right? But why don't we talk about religion in more depth? You know what I mean?
Okay,
we examine that? And I heard Dr. Strawn mention Rastafari, right? Because Rastafari is the only group who has been constantly talking about Africa, talking about slavery. But the thing about Rastafari is that Rastafari hears the Emperor Haile Selassie I, who is actually the King of Kings, which is objective truth. You know what I mean? That is objective truth. Why don't our public intellectuals have deeper conversations with us so that we can probably try to see why is it that we as black people can't get our society right?
Okay, so let me have Mr. Strawn respond. Is there space for at this conference for Rastafarian intellectuals, Rastafarian activists to come and participate and address some of these?
Of course, absolutely. It's free to the public. It will be open and promoted and streamed live. And so it's a democracy. And we welcome people who want to be a part of the conversation. I think issues as the caller is raising are very, very valid ones. People have differing views about it. But I think the matter of religion is a very sensitive one. It's a very, very sensitive one. Earlier on, you talked about African infusion in every religious experience that we have, which I agree with. But there's no doubt there's also been a demonization of the way black people experience the divine, experience the eternal. There has been. There was, as a consequence of slavery. Obeah was illegal, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to recover. There's a lot to review. There's a lot to reflect on. Not everything that we used to do in Africa, not every value that's traditionally African do I necessarily support or think was good. So we're not, it's not a black and white world if I may forgive me for using that.
Sankofa, we push forward, but we look back to bring the best forward.
Exactly, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that, right? So, but again, I think there's so much silence around these issues because we're uncomfortable, because we don't want to manage, maybe we don't want to manage the anger we might feel. It calls us to question so many things, right? The validity, the truth, and the truth is very political. How people define the truth is very political. I believe that we are better society, we're a stronger country when we let all the voices be heard. And we challenge our assumptions. And we also, and this is where I think we fundamentally have to grow as a country. What is missing in my mind from our country's governance mix is greater citizen-based, citizen-driven, non-partisan activism.
So this is going to be a citizen-based conference?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Now, I'll be honest. We've done this conference before. There will be people in the audience who are listening who have an interest, right? So we have had politicians attend, and they are welcome to attend.
Should attend.
University is the public, is the nation's property. And listen, I'm pretty certain that what they've heard has influenced their platforms and the things they promised they would do. I'm absolutely certain that that's the case. And we welcome that. We want them to listen.
Let's speak from the audience perspective.
Yeah.
Can a citizen like me come and attend and watch the presentation?
Anybody. It's free, and you're welcome to come. We'll try to schedule them at a time that we'll be working. People could actually show up. As I said, we're going to stream them as well. And then they'll be there.
And like a regular citizen like me, what can I expect? I'm walking into university now. I'm not sure where it's going to be.
Right. It'll be probably in the university's library, okay. Library auditorium.
And describe what is happening so I can, when I come there, I feel comfortable.
So basically what's going to happen is a day or evening of sessions. We might have panels depending on how many submissions we get, where these different topics are explored. For instance, I am very, very hopeful, or I hope that someone would talk about campaign finance reform, for instance, or let's even say the lecture that the professor will give Dr. Weiss on clientelism, so people can understand that concept and why it exists and how it operates and how it distorts or undermines democracy. Okay, we see play out writ large the impact that private money has on public policy in America. In the case of Elon Musk, right, for instance, and the role he played in the Trump victory, right? But we shouldn't fool ourselves. There are people who give to our elections with expectations, and they influence policy in ways that we cannot. We have to guess at because we don't have an open. We don't have an open system. The whole point of an open system is that people have to be a little bit more upfront and a little more above board. So there's been controversy, for instance, now about, well, what should a glass window bridge really cost to repair, right? So there are any number of conversations to be had around how do we make sure taxpayers' dollars are spent responsibly and people can answer for it, right? So even that procurement, being able to bid on a contract, getting a contract, doing the work, measuring whether you do that or not. We just want to educate people. We also want to sensitize. We want to maybe animate people. We also want to bring forth ideas that hopefully will shape the future. Hopefully there'll be people, young people there who, or others who may decide later on to get into politics, but they would be, hopefully they'll be influenced by what we say, and hopefully those who are already in politics will also be sensitive to what people are saying they need.
I'm hoping that people in politics will be bold enough to submit papers, but outside of, you know, the political campaign context, that we see bold and brand new ideas from people within that political realm, not afraid to voice ideas that may not be readily accessible by the party itself.
So you and I have a feeling you and I are interested in some of the same things in terms of what we want to talk about. I put the third parties of the future, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something I'm interested in discussing, is how could a third party actually ever gain the government of a bicameral system like this, a two-party first-past-the-post system like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, Canada has multiple party representatives. The UK has multiple party representatives. Even though there are two major parties, there are still smaller parties that have representation in their parliament. It's happened, but for brief slivers of time in the Bahamas, that like now we have Brother Lewis representing the COI in the House, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's going to last, and then we'll see if he gets reelected.
And we have plenty NDP representation in the PLP and FNM.
Exactly. So yeah. I'm interested in the whole phenomenon of how third parties are formed, what happens to them, and as Aaron already alluded or hinted at, they become co-opted, absorbed, they break up and become integrated. And that's interesting in itself because that's a necessity for the political parties to digest them,
mm-hmm.
because their existence is a problem, right? So just wanting to think about, so I'm pretty sure I'm going to present something on sort of gaming out how do you actually make a third party last more than 5 to 10 years and actually take government.
And can you, right? Because we've seen maybe one individual or two. I think, is it Depuch had a seat as a one-man party? He was like a one-man party. Right, as an independent, but he had a party name,
no,
I think.
Which Depuch? There's been more than one Depuch in the House. Which one are you talking about?
50, is it the 57 election?
Yes.
Anyway, but the idea that of Fred Mitchell, right, would have been, something like BDF, but a Fred Mitchell would have been a rogue, right? And then a PLP and a PLP in a party who said, we'll never have you in a party, right? Like, will we ever have a third party that could do that? Or by extension, will we ever have another Fred Mitchell? Will we ever have somebody who walked the line in between the parties and then and had a successful career? We see Renwood went from what? From NDP to
PLP.
To FNM, mm-hmm. right? But he ain't anywhere right now,
yeah.
right? He's only hoping he could get voted, but he could get nominated. Has anybody other than Fred Mitchell successfully walked that kind of path? Like, hey,
sure, quite a few. If you go all the way back, you have to the first split in the PLP was actually not the free PLP. It was actually when Paul Adley and Orville Turnquest created the NDP after Black Tuesday, right? And they contested the election, the 67 election, unsuccessfully, right? Even going back to the formation of the Progressive Party, the Puch and others created an alternate party that was not successful. I can't remember the name of it right now.
Anyway, go ahead.
And then, of course, you've had when BJ Nottage was unsuccessful in his bid to lead the PLP. That was so litigious, so nasty. He left and formed the CDR. And you have to remember that the CDR is actually where you got Fenton Niemoore from and Charlie Maynard, who were eventually integrated, right? And then even BJ himself returned to the
PLP,
PLP, right? So when at the time that Christie and Ingram were cast out of the PLP, and Mitchell was floating a third force, which didn't really materialize. But interestingly, there was a split in the FNM that caused a, was it the SDP? I can't remember the name of it, but they actually won more seats than the FNM. Mm. The FNM, because Henry Bostwick led them and they won, the FNM was actually a minority because of that split. So the history is an interesting one, but these breaks happen, they just don't last. The offshoots don't last. So I'm interested in exploring why that is, and how that might, were that not the case, would be better for us as a people, because there's definitely a desire in people for a third choice. Because
I can upset Mr. Nuri right now and say that I believe your good MP has been running a third party within the PLP for a number of administrations now. I just saying.
My MP alone, please.
You and Fox Hill, right?
And Fox
Hill. Yeah, I only bothering you. I ain't bothering him.
I don't know what you're trying to say about the chairman of the Progressive Party.
No. I wasn't talking about him. I was talking about the MP for Fox Hill.
Two different separate people.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
There's a split.
The split.
Yeah,
you may mistake him for the Minister of Foreign Affairs as well, but I was talking
about... Oh, that's a different door too.
Yeah. Yes.
This brother bad. Yeah.
There's always talk about Bahamas moving from a constitutional democracy, right, to a presidential concept, republic concept. Is there room for discussion?
Absolutely.
Like
if someone wants to take that on and explore that, we'd welcome that. Absolutely. And there's been talk about it. Some Caribbean countries have done it.
How have they really done it? Because it just seems to be the same thing with a governor general who's now called president.
Yeah. Well, what's the it that's supposed to be done, right? So what's the it that's supposed to be done? What problem are we trying to solve? And did they solve it by becoming a republic?
You're going to the same thing again.
So what's the real problem? And then what's the solution tailored to solve that problem, right? Or are we just doing something that seems progressive, that gratifies in some ways, but the foundational or the fundamental dynamics of party politics, of patronage or clientelism, of the oligarchy or whatever the dynamic is at play, none of that is fundamentally changing. There's still drastic inequality, there's still wide corruption, there's still great violence, there's still, you know, all of those.
Cultural imperialism, like in particular, renaming, right, this act of renaming, this act of restructuring, did it shift anything? There's still cultural imperialism. You still believe these, but embedded in you, no matter what you call yourself.
Okay, we have another caller who wants to engage you. And remind me of the date before we go to the caller.
Deadline for people who might want to submit something to me is June 30th. So that's ian.strawn@ub.edu.bs. You can send me an email. The conference itself is not until October 1st.
Now, Mr. Strawn, don't read that out loud. That's a text to you. Mr. Nuri, I'm really excited about the conference because I'm going to submit, right? But I think Bahamians are ready for it, right? Like, listening to the show, listening to people engage, I think people are ready to get involved and to participate and to listen and to join in.
Well, let's go to the caller here. I want to, hopefully, the conference speak about local government, local governance.
But then on the list,
and then the treat here, this managing of the Bahamas by just one group and not different levels of management or political structure. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of Bahamians have angst or concern or want to know if we can push that for that. But let's go to the caller here, and then we'll have Mr. Strawn address all of those. Go ahead, caller, Guardian Radio AM.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Green, Mr. Nui, and to Dr. Ian Strawn.
Morning.
Yeah, I always like his contribution. Yeah, I wanted to just touch on something you had mentioned earlier during the show, right? As it relates to the truth, you know, about the history, but when you was on that particular model.
Mm-hmm.
I have one question, and then I just make a comment, and then I listen to you to comment, but the comment wouldn't be about what I'm saying, but I just want you to comment on this. And I'm afraid that, you know, that during the Jews celebrate the Holocaust every year, and nobody says anything to them, but they have a problem and a contemptuous attitude towards us as relation to what you're saying. So, right, because you could appreciate being enlightened on our history, right? Especially in the local context and even on a global scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the question for me is it because you said they're afraid of the truth, right? But is it that? I mean, I get it is that, but is it because of retribution? That's what I'm saying. History makes no sense without applying common sense and actualization for a person like me.
Mm.
And then, do we really need another Fred Mitchell? Give thanks.
Yes. Hold on. Let me answer that one. Yes. You do. You don't have anybody. And I say, so like on this flyer, there's even a submission idea on institutional capture, which I imagine is capturing institutional knowledge, right?
No, it's political parties
literally capturing
institutions
and holding them hostage
and subverting the work they do so that what they do is not necessarily the public good but the political good of that party.
Yeah.
So, for instance, you see this happening on a grand scale with Trump.
Yeah.
Firing the head of the Library of Congress, making himself head of the Kennedy Center, you know, planting people in the FBI. So they do his will, right? So for instance, once you politically capture an institution, now your decisions right. about how you procure, they have to
right.
serve
you,
the party.
You can't capture it successfully without subverting the institutional knowledge. So what Trump did, Trump brought in 12-year-olds.
Yeah.
Respectfully.
Yeah. Right. So the point you're making is a good one. Yes, that's how institutional capture works, right? You plant people who are loyal to you and don't understand the integrity of the organization, the role it plays in national life.
Mm-hmm.
They solely focus on what the political priority is for the people in power.
And that's why you need to know why you can't find Jerry Roker in town to be in the Senate. That's why.
Well, you know, one of the things I hope we could talk about is, you know, how do we get more women elected, right? How do we get more women in the cabinet?
So something like that conversation, who would spearhead that conversation? Who would you invite? Who would you want to come and participate in that?
Now, I have done that in the past. We have done it in the past. We have written directly to individuals who haven't had a certain role in national life, and we invite them to come and talk about their work and so that's something that any citizen who cares about that could speak to. But we might also decide, for instance, in that instance, to invite someone who has served in the parliament, who's now stepped away, who's a woman, who might talk about her experience and how we replicate or how we get more women involved, right? So that's something we could do and probably should do, right? So mm-hmm. that there's that. But to the speaker's point again, or to the caller's point, I do think that we both don't know our history and are afraid to know our history because of all the implications. Now that I know, can I continue to behave the way I did before, right? Or do I, now that I know better, do I have to do better? And how do I relate to people whose ancestors did something to my ancestors that I'm still living with the negative consequences of? How do I hold those two things in my head at the same time?
Well, we're going to take a quick break now. Oh, it's 12 o'clock. It's 12 o'clock. You see how this just went by so quickly. Sorry, caller. We got to go. Thank you very much, Ian. Like, let you wrap up quickly.
So again, I invite people to, they can go on my Facebook page. There's the announcement. We'll promote it one more time, but it's the Future Democracy Conference, which will be October 1st through the 3rd. But if you'd like to participate or present, just send me a blurb, 50, 200 words, describing what you want to talk about to my email, ian.strawn@ub.edu.bs.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Dr. Strawn. Thank you very much, Aaron Green. This has been Guardian Radio AM. We'll invite him back closer to the time just to remind us what is happening and where to go and how to show up. I like when things have food, but anyway, we can leave that alone.
Happy Juneteenth.
Happy Juneteenth. I'm going to raise on Facebook. Have a wonderful day.
Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, streaming on GuardianTalkRadio.com and the Guardian Radio app, Nassau, Bahamas.